Now, did you know that almost 3 million Iraqis, not Syrians, Iraqis, are now displaced people, according to the UN? Numbers not seen since the height of Iraq's sectarian civil war 8 to 9 years ago. The vast majority are Sunni Muslims. And yes, I hear you saying, aren't the Daesh or the IS full of Sunnis? They are. But they're very aggressively fighting the now Shiite forces of establishment in Iraq, and they're oblivious to any resulting collateral damage, even for their own group. Just one of the reasons why David Kilcullen, the Australian-born counterinsurgency specialist now Washington-based, believes there's no alternative but to escalate the conflict with IS into a full conventional engagement without any occupation or ground troops, though with different rules of engagement. The fall this week of the city of Ramadi in Anbar province, that big vital piece of territory to the west of Iraq, has just further crystallised his views. Welcome to Saturday Extra.
Thank you for having me.
David, you've written your latest quarterly essay on this issue, calling it Blood Year, the year of 2014. Mm. And you do say we have to go hard now, or we'll end up having to go in much harder, potentially on a much larger scale later, or accept defeat. So I'd like to hear from you, what does victory look like? What does defeat look like?
Yeah, no, this is a great question. I mean, I think what I'm more concerned about right now is how do we stop this very extreme escalation of violence that's going on across the Middle East. And you already talked about some of it. You know, 9 million Syrians are refugees as well. We're looking at the most unprecedented numbers of asylum seekers and refugees as a result of this. 200,000 dead in Syria. But actually, that's not the worst of it. The worst of it is that this conflict is now drawing in Iran, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Russia, Israel. You know, you can go on with a pretty extensive list of regional and global powers that are getting sucked into this escalating conflict. About half a dozen of those powers are nuclear-armed or nuclear-threshold countries. And that, to me, is the important risk. So I think we don't want to be talking about victory exactly. For me, what success looks like is containing that conflict and stopping it from expanding to the point where it really, you know, totally trashes the Middle East and makes enormous human tragedy unstoppable.
Just as you're speaking, is this in a way the 2015 version of the 1914 conflagration? Is it sort of drifting into something far bigger?
It certainly is going in that direction. It's not there yet, but it's going there. You know, and I think people that don't understand the geography, it seems like it's all fairly big, but it's a really small area, right? These places are right on top of each other, and it's actually turned from a terrorist campaign against the West under Al-Qaeda into something that's much more about provoking a Sunni-Shia sectarian conflict.
Just before people turn off their radios because they find it so terribly depressing, is there hope here?
Yeah, there is hope. I mean, I think that actually, and one of the things that I've said is that we're not talking about reoccupying Iraq. We're not talking about a large-scale counterinsurgency campaign. What we're talking about is a campaign roughly on the scale of Kosovo in 1999 or Libya in 2011, or a better analogy possibly is the invasion of Afghanistan in 2001, which took about 6 weeks and only about 400 troops, but 50,000 Afghans fighting on the side of the international community against the Taliban. And those guys were people who were organized and fought in a very similar way to how ISIS does today. And they lasted, you know, a few weeks against the international community. But in those campaigns, we were running 80, 100, in the case of Kosovo, 250 airstrikes a day. In Iraq for the last 10 months, in fact, across both of Iraq and Syria, we've only been doing about 10 per day.
Yes, I heard you say that to Lee Sales on 7:30, and I was really quite surprised. In that light, does Ramadi's defeat surprise you or not?
Well, Ramadi's been contested for a year, and there's been a strong ISIS presence in the outskirts of the city. No, it's been coming for a while. The issue is actually political as much as it is military. So the Iraqi politicians, it gets back to your first point, right? The Iraqi politicians knew that Ramadi was under significant threat. They wanted to send the Shia sectarian militia and their Iranian advisors in to defend the city weeks ago. But coalition commanders and the US tried to talk them out of it because it's a Sunni city, it's the capital of Sunni Anbar. You bring in all these guys, it suddenly is sectarian. And so against their better judgment, the Iraqi government sort of said, okay, well, we'll try to defend the city with just the Iraqi army and this Sunni tribal militia. And of course, they failed. So now people in Baghdad are blaming the coalition for the loss of Ramadi. And they've sent literally thousands of these sectarian militia to the east of Ramadi, where they're engaged in a fight with ISIS right now.
But look, this is what is so fascinating, because obviously there were some real hopes, and we've had some very good reporting from the New York Times on this, about the effort to use rhetoric to inspire those Sunnis to fight alongside Shiites,
right?
And it just didn't work. When you really stand back, before we go into detail, you know, David, do you think that the West's lack of deep, deep understanding about the epic nature of this Sunni-Shia divide is the major takeout from this? And is that the sort of massive mistake that was made?
I do think that you just can't get away from invading Iraq in the first place, right, as the major mistake, because there wouldn't be an ISIS if we hadn't invaded Iraq. But there also wouldn't be an ISIS as there is today if we hadn't have left Iraq precipitately and caused a breakdown that led to kind of a zero sum between Sunnis and Shia in Iraq, and that sort of generated the conflict that we're dealing with now. I think people tend to default to thinking about ISIS like it's the same as Al-Qaeda, right? Because, you know, terrorists are terrorists, and how different are they? But actually, they're very different.
But I'm actually saying, like, when you were there with David Petraeus doing, and it really was, I think, pretty successful, effort to go beyond the obvious collaboration, did you come to terms with, or was there a way of bridging this gulf or not? Does the West just have to give up on any hope of this?
No, I don't think so. I mean, there are plenty of places in the Middle East where Sunnis and Shia coexist, but it is a very deep rift, and it's a historically very violent rift that a lot of people don't fully understand in the West.
I agree. I think we default to, we look back and we say, well, we had the two centuries of terrible sectarianism, you know, in the sort of 16th and 17th.
Right.
But somehow or other, that's not helping, I don't think, the West deal with this.
Yeah, I mean, Ali Alawi, who's a Shia secular politician in Iraq, has talked about how this is a little bit like Europe's 30 Years' War. Mm. So the analogy to us in that historical comparison would be the Ottoman Empire trying to intervene in Europe in the 30 Years' War. It's pretty hard if you don't understand the dynamics, you know. And I think this even is worse than that, because it goes on a lot longer and it's a lot more violent than even the 30 Years' War, which is hard for people to believe, but it's you know, it's been going around for a long time. No, I think when we had a substantial number of troops and advisors and political folks on the ground in Iraq, for a brief period of time, the Iraqis, including Nouri al-Maliki, the prime minister at the time, behaved in a much more inclusive fashion. And we actually had the beginnings of getting these guys to work together and to pull it out of where it had been. But that all went away as soon as we pulled our troops out.
David Kilcullen is my guest, whose quarterly essay is called Blood Year, Terror and the Islamic State. I mean, why should the West necessarily get involved? There are analysts like George Friedman from Stratfor, very much a realist, and who says that there is a new balance of powers developing within the Middle East and the Levant. It's being brought into life right now. This is always a messy procedure wherever it happens down through the centuries. And that it's the players there who are negotiating this through blood, has to be said, and that the US, and by definition Australia, doesn't have to try to force the pace or become involved. Do you have any sympathy with this?
Well, I've read George's stuff, and I think he's very rational about it. And his argument, I think, is that essentially step out of the way and let this thing stabilize
over time.
You know, if it were not for the nukes, I think that you could make that case. But what we're talking about is not a choice between the West intervening and no one intervening. It's either us or it's the Russians, the Iranians, the Saudis and others who, as I said earlier, are either actual or potential nuclear powers. And, you know, the Israelis too. I mean, the Israelis have already struck a couple of times into Syria and have talked about strikes more deeply if this continues to escalate. So again, it's not like it's either we do it or it doesn't happen. It's either it's done in accordance with international norms in a way that the international community supports, or in a very different way and a very bloody way on the ground.
You do say in your essay that greater Western involvement would mitigate quite a lot of the problems that you've just described, since regional countries, Iraq included, much prefer US assistance against ISIS and are accepting Iranian help mainly for lack of other options.
Mm. Yeah, that's right.
Do you know this or do you want this to be true?
So people may not be aware, I run four teams on the ground in Syria and a team in Iraq. We do work for NGOs and aid agencies. So we get a lot of very granular detail about what people want and don't want. And there's a lot of anger against ISIS and there's a lot of Sunnis who don't like ISIS. The thing is, if your choice is ISIS or the Iranians, then for a Sunni, there's not much choice because you know that, you know, you just have to look at what's happened.
But the Iranians are sending in the death squads. I mean, who've been behind all the Shiite death squads.
Yeah, more than that. I mean, they also have sent advisors and money and a bunch of other things. And that's right. But that's the choice that Al-Qaeda in Iraq, now ISIS, has been trying to force on Sunnis, right? It's either us or the Sunni death squads or the Shiite
death squads. The people who've been the death squads.
Right.
I mean, there's a very interesting quote. I'm going to read it to you from a young man, a 38-year-old, Amir Abdul, a resident of Anbar, who told the New York Times, "The Shiite militias going to Anbar are a non-governmental force. They're undisciplined and uncontrolled, and even the Prime Minister doesn't control these militias. They're directly connected to Iran."
And he's right about that. And Nouri al-Maliki, the former Prime Minister, is now playing quite a disruptive role on the sidelines in and among these militias. And you've got to remember about Maliki that he lived for 22 years as an exile from Saddam's Iraq in two places, Damascus and Tehran. So he's very close to both Assad's regime and to the Iranians.
He will not go down in history as a man to admire.
He's pushing there's an alternative, you know, option there that people are always aware of.
Yeah. And look, you also had this very interesting, in terms of how we did go in, we, meaning the coalition, I suppose, you have this stinging criticism of drones and rulers in the West who succumb to the allure of predator porn. What's that?
That's a term we use in the theatre in Iraq. You often see people glued to the screen looking at, you know, the imagery that comes from Predator remotely piloted aircraft, and they think, well, if I can see it on the Pred, then it must be, you know, must be real. Without, I think, to me, the image that best sums this up is the one that people may be familiar with of President Obama and his cabinet sitting around the table in the Situation Room as the raid was going in on Osama bin Laden, you know, and everyone then talking tough afterwards about how tough they were. It's like, dude, you watched a show on television, you know? Like, and people, I think, they have this sense of immediacy about it, but really, you're not on the ground, you don't know what's going on. You know, I mean, it's a fact of life, unfortunately.
But I think you're pro-drones, though, aren't you?
I think they're a great tool for things like surveillance and intelligence collection. And they go back to, like, Bosnia, right? I mean, we've been using them for 20 years, and they were very effective in a lot of the humanitarian stuff in Kosovo in identifying where the displaced people were and where the massacres were going on. But when you remove the risk from killing people and you make it something that happens extrajudicially outside war zones at the push of a button from someone in a peacetime location, I think that's extraordinarily dangerous.
You mean gives you bad tactical decision making?
Well, but it's what I would call a moral hazard, right? It's a ethical temptation to politicians to just take the easy route of killing somebody rather than thinking about, actually, there are complex social and political problems that are driving this. It isn't just that. I mean, I also critique special forces raids. And the example that I use is October 2013, US put in a unilateral special operations raid into Tripoli in Libya to take a guy, Abu Anas al-Libi, who was one of the people accused of the African embassy bombings in 1998. They already knew the guy had liver cancer. They picked him up. He died before they could put him on trial, right? So that's what we got from doing that raid. The cost of it was Ali Zaidan, who was at that time the Prime Minister of Libya, was kidnapped by a bunch of people who were upset about the raid. His government collapsed. The whole state of Libya collapsed. And now we've got this massive civil war going on in Libya. So, yeah, we got one dude who we put on trial. He didn't even make it to trial. And we already knew that was probably going to happen before we already got the guy. And the price of that is now the chaos that we're seeing in Libya. You have to ask yourself, is it an addiction at this point that we sort of have political leaders who are addicted to the easy, apparently easy, if you're not involved in it, you know, special operations raid or drone strike, rather than actually engaging with the real nature of the problem here.
Mm. Finally, would you be welcoming home foreign fighters to Australia who've had enough, or would you be offering a frank go away, we don't want you back, as our Prime Minister says?
I think there's a middle course, which is, you know, if you do go over to Iraq and Syria to join Islamic State, you are breaking a whole bunch of Australian laws. And if you want to come back, you've got to face the music, right? And that means, you know, a legal process that may or may not result in you going to jail. But I think, you know, I can sit here and say a lot of people who go to Iraq and Syria to join the Islamic State discover that it's not what they thought, and
well, they're cannon fodder,
and they discover that they get, you know, they're going to get blown away in a suicide bombing, and a lot of them get disillusioned and realize that you know, they made a mistake. But you know what? Me saying that doesn't really count, you know, because I'm the counterterrorism guy. Of course, I'm going to say that. You know, it's when you get someone who was there who says, "No, let me tell you what it's really like." I think that's a very powerful dissuading factor.
So you've got to have a sort of, if you're right, you've got to have like a conditional return. You come back in a qualified right to come back.
Yeah, or you know, you make your radio broadcast trying to dissuade people from going to ISIS from jail. You know, I mean, I think people have to recognize that it is kind of a one-way system. You go over there, it's really unlikely that you're going to make it back, you know. And not only, if I were those people, I wouldn't be so much worried about what the Australian government's going to do. I'd be worried about ISIS, because ISIS has a long history of killing people who try to leave the organisation.
I haven't got time to talk to you about the extraordinary theses about the violence that they're meeting out and what a millenarian sort of metaphor it offers. But
yeah,
that's for another day, David Kilcullen. It's great to have you here in Australia. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you for having me. It was great to talk.
And David Kilcullen has written the quarterly essay Blood Year, Terror and the Islamic State. And can I alert you to Background Briefing tomorrow morning called Islamic State, the Social Media War. So they're taking that story quite a lot further. We'll also try to take up another time David Kilcullen's discussions about the need for a negotiated Syrian peace and why he thinks it could be closer than you think. He says a lot.